Good morning. It is 9:04 Wednesday, September 23rd. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And I'm not Richard Gere, but it's autumn in New York.
I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. Surprised to see Joe smiling the way he is as his Jets are once again 0-2.
I'm almost off of that drug, so...
Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable, and I greatly appreciate my fellow podcasters for carrying the ball in my absence. I think you guys safely carried the ball as well as Saquon Barkley did this year.
I'm Alan Carrasco, managing editor of the TDN. Contrary to popular belief, I am not being nominated for the opening on the Supreme Court.
Look at Carrasco on top of his game already.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Reminder that the Keeneland September sale is still going on this week. It ends on Friday, September 25th. Our man John Green just got back from the Keeneland September sale and has some news related to both the Keeneland September sale and the Writers Room, which we'll get to a little later. That's what you call a tease. And after that, after the September sale wraps up, we will have the Keeneland Fall Meet and then the Breeders' Cup and Keeneland November as well. So obviously a busy time of year for Keeneland. Seems to be going pretty smoothly so far with the September sale. So best of luck to everybody at Keeneland for the next couple of months. I know you guys will be busy. So we finally had a couple of dominoes drop in the FBI indictment scandal that goes back all the way until March. It was kind of all quiet on the Western Front there for a little bit. Didn't have any real news to speak of. But this past week, there were two guilty pleas of two kind of lesser players, Scott Robinson and Sarah Izaki. And they had, I'll let Bill explain most of it, but they had greater charges that they pled guilty and pled down to lesser charges. Seems to implicate, the implication seems to be that they're talking to the feds and they're cooperating and they might throw some other people under the bus. You might have some new indictments. But Bill did some good work on this in his week in review. So toss it over to him and what his impressions are.
Yeah, Joe, first of all, let's keep in mind, this is all just speculation. I mean, nobody knows the facts outside of the Justice Department and the FBI, and obviously they're not talking right now. But of the 27 people that were originally indicted, we've had no pleas or guilty or innocent charges to anybody till this week, when the two people, Sarah Izaki, as you said, and Scott Robinson, both pled guilty. Now, a couple things that are pertinent, why their guilty pleas are important. First of all, they were among the drug suppliers. They were the ones people were buying the stuff off of, the Red Devil and Monkey and SGF 1000 and whatnot. They were the ones they were buying it off of. And also, they had what was called a superseding indictment. So the indictments that were released last week were different from the original indictments against these two. The superseding indictments included lesser charges, particularly for Izaki, who was originally up for, in addition to the drug rebranding and misbranding and whatever the heck they call that thing, a smuggling charge, which carried a penalty of 20 years. So, you know, even though it's just speculation, it's pretty clear what's likely going on here is that the government went to these two, or the lawyers for these two went to the government and said, we'll talk, let's give us a deal. And then when we work out a deal, we'll start spilling the beans. Now, what does this mean? Well, it could mean a lot of things, but it definitely raises the possibility that these two were selling drugs to a lot more than Navarro Service and a couple other people that were indicted. And they may have a list of names that, who knows, could be 50, 60. I have no idea. But again, just speculation. But it seems to be going down a road where maybe we're going to get more people indicted for using drugs and potentially a lot more people. So as they say, stay tuned.
Yeah, and Bill, I really, with all sincerity, I have to compliment you on this article because it allowed a layperson like myself to understand what was going on, not only in for those two particular individuals, but also with regard to how the legal system works and the fact that there's probably a plea deal in place. I believe, if I remember correctly, we heard kind of hints about other indictments coming down the pike from people pretty high up in the Jockey Club, as well as, at the Breeders' Cup. And I just remember reading other implications that were kind of coming down the line. Have you heard, not specific names, but have you heard anything about other trainers or owners or veterinarian suppliers that may be coming out soon?
I mean, not really. I've talked to people since this started, and everybody said there's going to be another shoe to drop. There's going to be more people. But so far as names or, you know, whether it be other veterinarians, other trainers, other owners, I mean, that's just guesswork. And, you know, the one thing about the federal government, especially when you get into grand juries, is that, I mean, they can't talk about this stuff. There's not even generally any leaks out of a grand jury. There's not supposed to be anything along those lines. And the other thing is right now in the original case, we're in what's called the discovery process. That's when the government has to turn over their all their evidence to the plaintiff's attorney so they can go through it. And also that is very hush-hush as well. So I don't think we're going to really learn anything more until one of two possible things happen. Number one is the sentencing for Izaki and Robinson. One is in December and one is in January. And when they get sentenced, if they go before the court and the court says, okay, we've reached a deal with the Department of Justice, the Attorney General. Remember that the penalties for these crimes, this misbranding of drug adulteration, is 5 years in jail. So if they come before the court, and this will be all obviously very public, and they say, you've given 1 month in jail plus 5 years probation or something like that, then you know, that's game, set, match. They obviously cooperated. And, you know, there's a possibility that some more indictments could be announced. I don't know. It could be any day from now. It could be a year from now. I have no idea. But specifics right now are in short supply, John.
Oh, it was interesting that the sentencing hearings are coming up, I mean, relatively quickly relative to what might be happening with Navarro and service. God knows how long those are going to take. But, you know, I said a few months ago, it's just good that to keep people on the ball. And I think, Bill, I think Jeff Gural told you that, you know, anybody that has dealt with these people should really be feeling the pinch right now. It's just good, you know, it's good to, we still need to weed out the bad stuff. And it's good to see that these things are still happening. You know, it's in their best interest to cooperate, and, you know, let's see what that produces.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was a little discouraging that we heard so little about this since March. There seemed to be very little movement. And that was one of our concerns, our shared concern at the beginning of this, was that the feds would just drop these indictments. This would be it. And then they would pack up and leave, and we would be left with, you know, the aftermath and dealing with all that. The hope now seems to be that there are more names coming, and there have been rumors that have been floated about that. There have been unsealed indictments that that came out a couple of weeks ago. We don't know exactly whose names are in them, but this is the kind of thing that, you know, all we need is like this little drip. All we need is this little drip of information to think that there's more big names coming, because the idea that Service and Navarro and a handful of veterinarians, getting rid of them is going to clean up the sport, obviously, is ridiculous. It's such a more widespread problem than that. And we talked about this, and we wondered whether or not there were going to be people talking and people singing and giving up, you know, bigger names than themselves. And it seems like, at least in this small bit of what we've learned, it seems like that is happening. And I think that gives a lot of hope for a more wide ranging, broad, you know, in scope of indictments that may still be to come. So yeah, like Bill said, stay tuned, but definitely a little bit of encouragement on that front when it seemed like there really wasn't anything going on for a while. And we just were kind of left with the initial indictments, and that was it.
So the guy to really keep an eye on here is Robinson. We don't know a whole lot, but this guy apparently had a serious business going on. In the announcement last week that these people had pled guilty, the government referred to his business having made quote unquote millions. And on top of that, and these are all new terms to me, all these legal terms, but there's something called a forfeiture. Whereas if you get ill-gotten gains from committing a crime, you've got to pay that money back to the government. And Robinson, in addition to putting in the guilty plea, also agreed to a forfeiture to the government of $3.8 million. So this was not a guy selling, you know, $50 worth of bad pills out of the back of his car or something like that. And he is also selling most of his things on the internet as well. So if you think about a guy selling lots of drugs to lots of people on the internet, the paper trail is going to be huge on this. I mean, he's got to have credit card receipts, internet transactions. So again, just like Alan said, that what Jeff Corral said. If you're out there right now and you were doing business with these guys, you're probably having some very sleepless nights.
Yeah, I remember some kind of statistic from back in March when we were talking about the, you know, when the federal government comes in and you know, arrests people and indicts them, it was like a 90 something percent conviction rate. So they have all the paper trail and all the receipts and all the documents and the, and, you know, allegedly the conversations and text messages and everything like that. So I think it's just a matter of them continuing to do their due diligence and also seeing how much information they can squeeze out of the people that have been indicted. And hopefully this will continue to root out, you know, some of the people that are not doing the right things in the industry and it'll move forward. You know, Joe, like you alluded to before, it's been a roller coaster because I think in March we were all very excited is probably the wrong word, but we felt good about the fact that somebody else was coming in and starting to police our industry. And then it went like, you know, deathly silent for a number of months where we didn't hear anything. And there were rumors and speculations. And then everyone, you know, started looking at other people in the industry and are they cheating? Are they not? Looking at their statistics and making innuendos, but there was no real palpable information that we could, you know, make any conclusions on. That's why I was so pleased to see Bill's, you know, report on this, because it looks like that the Fed is being their methodical self and they are making sure that there is no, you know, way that the people they're prosecuting can come back and say that it was done, you know, without proper evidence or proper form. So if it takes a little longer to make sure we get it done right, then I'm all in favor for it. But we all are yearning for kind of some information just to find out, you know, who else is involved or what else is going to happen. And I think that that'll be coming sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I think Bill's point is right that this guy wasn't like a low level dealer. He seemed to have a lot of clients and amazingly a paper trail. I don't know why you would ever do anything like this online, but apparently, like Brian said at the beginning, apparently they've never seen The Wire. Are you taking notes on a criminal conspiracy? But yeah, it seems like there's going to be a lot more clients that'll come out, and we hope so. And you know, it's got to be patient, I guess. At least there's some kind of movement. Owning multiple graded stakes, winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is possible with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Learn why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. So we had some news on Tis the Law that broke yesterday. He's not going to run in the Preakness. He's going to train instead up to the Breeders' Cup. He just suffered his first defeat in the Derby and just not 100% yet. So Jack Knowlton posted on the Saratoga Stable Twitter yesterday that he's going to train straight up to the Breeders' Cup. Would have only had 4 weeks rest between the Derby and the Preakness. Instead, he'll have a full 9 weeks to go up to the Breeders' Cup Classic. A little bit of a disappointment. We kind of wanted to see that rematch between him and Authentic. Disappointment for me personally, because I'm in a neck and neck battle with Al in the fantasy contest. So now it's basically down, I would say, to Art Collector versus Authentic, and to figure out who's gonna win this contest. I feel okay about it, but you know, I think the mile and 3/16ths. If Authentic could get a mile and a quarter, it's mile and 3/16ths is going to be even more up his alley. But as far as Tis the Law, you know, this is kind of the first real setback he's had in his career. I don't know if you want to say the Kentucky Jockey Club when he ran third, but he wasn't Tis the Law then. He came into this three-year-old year like a rocket ship with four straight wins, Belmont, the Traverse. And then after that, you know, this was his first defeat as a three-year-old. And this was the first time that, you know, there was a little bit of a chink in the armor for Tis the Law. And he just, I can understand him needing a little bit more time and them being a little bit more careful here. So it's disappointing we won't see that rematch in the Preakness, but you know, I think all along we thought that the Preakness being in that spot on the calendar between the Derby and the Breeders' Cup might mean a little bit of a tricky position, because a lot of people, if they're even, you know, a little bit concerned about the horse are going to skip it and train up to the Breeders' Cup. So,
well, it wouldn't be appropriate to question Barkley Tagg. He's a great trainer. He knows what he's doing. And if he says the horse isn't right to run the Preakness, you know, you got to take that at face value. But remember, he said pretty much within minutes after the Derby that he didn't want to go to the Preakness, period. And I think the bigger story is, and I sound like a broken record, I've been talking about this for the last 20 years, is what has happened to horse racing? I mean, here's a horse that would be 8-5 in a $1 million Triple Crown race, and the connections found a way not to run him in there. I mean, they didn't say that he's, you know, in bad shape or anything like that. They just sort of said, you know, he's not exactly perfect. We want to take a step back. And, you know, now we're talking about a horse that's run all of 5 times this year. And that seems like in this day and age, a huge campaign. And, you know, it's not going to change. There's nothing I can do about it. You know, I'm just, you know, saying things that I think a lot of people feel. But, you know, again, it's emblematic of what has happened to horse racing. And part of the pattern here, too, is we're losing the fall. Because now, how many times have we picked up the TDN or some other publication to read so-and-so to train up to Breeders' Cup? I mean, everybody is training up to the Breeders' Cup. So it's not like nobody runs after Saratoga and Del Mar anymore, and it's getting worse and worse all the time. You know, what's it doing to all the great fall races like the Jockey Club Gold Cup and things like that? You know, it's not good for the game, but, you know, trainers like Barkley Tagg certainly are very good at what they do, and I think he thinks he's doing the right thing by the horse and giving him this best chance to win the Breeders' Cup, but it's not good for the sport.
Yeah, and Bill, the only thing I would jump in on is I understand from, you know, from the campaigning side of it that you want your horse to peak in the most meaningful races. And once, you know, he lost the Derby and didn't have a chance to win the Triple Crown or the Quadruple Crown, you know, because the Run Happy Travers was kind of slotted in between a couple of these races, it didn't make sense for them to run him in the Preakness anymore because that wasn't the most important race. The most important race now is going to be the Classic. And I understand what you're saying as far as for racing purposes, it would be great to have the horse run and have a rematch in the Preakness and have him complete the Triple Crown races running in all three. But I understand where they're coming from. That's not the important race anymore. I mean, he's already won the Belmont. He already ran second in the Derby. He won the Travers. So he's got his important grade ones on his resume. Winning the Preakness wouldn't necessarily do anything for his resume. Yes, it would earn him more money, but the most important race right now on the radar is for him to try to tackle older horses in the Classic, which is not going to be an easy task. You know, even with this, you know, with this respite in between, with 7-8 weeks in between races. So as an industry, I understand where you're coming from. I agree that I'd love to have these horses run more often. But I understand where the owners and the trainers coming from as far as making sure that the horse is peaking to run against older horses. And I don't think it's just horse racing where we're seeing this. We're seeing it in college football as these players, these top players start to graduate and go into the NFL combine and the NFL draft. A lot of these guys, you know, are skipping the all-star games. A lot of them are skipping their bowl games because they want to get ready. And even this year, I know COVID's 2020 is a weird year, but this year, a lot of the top prospects are even skipping the entire season because they want to get ready for the draft. Why? Well, yeah, I'm sure a guy from Michigan would love to play Ohio State and play against, you know, their rival. But the reality of it is that he's got bigger fish to fry in the NFL draft. And I think that's what we're seeing in this industry as well, is that these guys are looking for the brass ring. And right now for 'tis the law in their camp, the brass ring is the Breeders' Cup Classic.
How do I follow that, John? I mean, that was a wild analogy.
He's been holding it in for 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Wow. So here's the rest of the story. The story that's never been told is that while Barkley was unsaddling 'Tis the Law after the Derby, I was on the phone with him saying, please don't run in the Preakness because I can win this contest.
You have that kind of power, huh?
I do.
No one give him Tom Drury's number.
I understand the disappointment. I always think these things come down to business decisions, and I never begrudge horse owners whose their horse is a giant asset. And they've sold him to stud, and so they have to manage him the way that they choose. They don't owe anything to me or you, John, or Bill, or Joe, or the racing public as racing fans. They don't owe us anything. They have to manage the horse in the way that they see fit. And like John said, the goal now is the Breeders' Cup Classic. if he was knocked around a little bit in the Derby. I mean, it was, you know, the Derby was just 4 weeks after the Traverse State, just. So, you know, the three races in order, you know, they're liable to take something out of the horse. And, you know, they want to win the Breeders' Cup Classic on the first Saturday of November. You know, I'm not going to begrudge them that. Is it disappointing? Would you like to see the rematch? Of course you would. That being said, you know, it's not that his absence is going to make the Preakness a dull race with Art Collector and Authentic. You got new shooters like Mystic Guide and Happy Saber coming in. So, you know, listen, it's the third leg of a Triple Crown. It's going to be the anchor of a big day at Pimlico. And, you know, I'm going to see the glasses half full.
I mean, like, Tis the Law is not Secretariat. Like, he's a very nice three-year-old, but it's not like the average person knows who Tis the Law is, and it's going to be this huge ratings plunge because Tis the Law isn't in the Preakness. I mean, I kind of agree with all you guys. I agree with Bill that, you know, five starts in, what is it, 9 months should not be too taxing of a campaign, but it's the world we live in now. And it's, you know, they didn't have to run him the Travers. They ran him in the Travers, ran great, got to kind of show out for the Saratoga people and for the upstate New York crowd as it was surrounding the track. But yeah, so, you know, I'm kind of with all you guys, but yeah, it's disappointing on a personal level that I'm not going to have the two-headed monster in the Preakness to try to beat back the challenge of Hal. But you know, still an interesting race. We'll still preview it next week, and there'll still be plenty to talk about.
There's another thing I want to bring up on this, and that's the three-year-old championship. And let's assume that neither Authentic nor Tis the Law will win the Breeders' Cup Classic. If they do, they're the three-year-old champion and probably horse of the year. But if they don't, and it's going to be hard for either one to win against Improbable, Tom's to Todd and Maximum Security, then the three-year-old championship might be decided in the Preakness. And if Authentic wins it, he's going to be three-year-old champion. And at one point, Tis the Law looked like an absolute cinch to be three-year-old champion. And by walking away from the Preakness, where they obviously could cement things by beating Authentic, you know, they're also taking a big risk that they are not going to get that title, which I'm sure is very important to them. But again, I'm not going to go on and on and on about this. I understand all the points that everybody else has made. Yeah, you know, those five starts, man, that poor thing. He must be really gassed by now.
You know, Bill, you bring up a really good point, though, about the three-year-old championship, because if neither of them do well, then it's up for grabs. I mean, does it become, you know, fall right into the lap of Harvey's Little Goyle?
Well, she's a three-year-old filly champion, of course.
Well, she can cross over.
Right.
Presumptive three-year-old filly champion, Harvey's Little Goyle. But yeah, it's, I mean, he's got, Tis the Law's got three grade ones, so it's going to be tough to beat him unless I think Authentic wins both the Preakness and the Classic. So I think they're taking like a little bit of a calculated risk on that they've already done enough to hold off any incoming challengers. But yeah, I mean, and I don't think there's any three-year-olds. Like last year, we had Code of Honor, who went after the older horses in the Jockey Club Gold Cup, and that kind of got him in the conversation. But it's, with the Preakness where it is now, and then the Classic, I don't think we're gonna have any of those challenges, at least until the Breeders' Cup. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtv.com. So we had major movement on our favorite topic here on the TDN Writers Room, which is whip reform. So this past week, there's been movement in three different states, different levels of development. In New Jersey, New Jersey had the strictest, most wide-ranging new rule at the Gaming Commission meeting or the Racing Commission meeting. They're deciding that they're going to ban the whip basically completely from racing in New Jersey, other than if the rider feels it's necessary in the safety of the horse, which I guess leaves a little bit of gray area, but we'll see how that ends up being adjudicated. And then in California, there are going to be more restrictions put in place. And in New York, which has kind of been a little bit behind the curve on this, it seems, the New York State Gaming Commission met about it. And it seems like there will be some movement in the future. We don't have a ton of details yet, but it seems like New York is trending towards some sort of restriction on the whip. At least, I mean, I know you guys know my feelings on this. I think it's bad for bettors, and it's just, it's not going to, it's to me, it's a greater risk than reward, because the risk is going to be borne by the existing customer base, whereas the reward, small as it is going to be received by people who I think are never going to be customers in racing to begin with. So that's my feeling. You guys know my feeling, but it seems like this is the way the world is going in racing. As much as I rail about it, or as much as jockeys rail about it, I think it's a little interesting that there seems to be nearly unanimous feeling amongst jockeys that this is a bad idea for them. And nevertheless, the powers that be in racing are continuing to go along this path. But I know where Bill stands, but it's just a little bit of a reaction to how quickly this is moving on this topic.
Yeah, Joe, I mean, one thing you're definitely right about, I know we disagree on the subject, but one thing I agree with, this is the direction racing is going. And, you know, it might take 10 years from now, but I think it's safe to say in 10 years from now, there will probably be no whipping in racing, at least in the major jurisdictions. I think the New Jersey thing, though, is obviously extremely important. And I think it's going to solve the debate. I would rather table this discussion because we've beat this thing to death on the writer's room and just, you know, among our friends and talking about it. I'd like to table the discussion to the end of the 2021 Monmouth meeting. They'll start, they wanted to start this thing right away. And Dennis Drazen, the head of Monmouth, got them to put it off till 2021. And if there is no precipitous change or drop in handle, and there are no obvious issues with safety, and I think that is going to be the case. I could be wrong. I could be completely wrong. What then will everybody think of the whip issue? And maybe the rules in Canada they're not nearly as strict as what has happened in New Jersey. But about this time last year, I was calling the jockeys at Woodbine. And the rule there is you can only hit the horse with that underhanded motion. You can't reach back and crack them like they used to be. And they're saying the same things. This is going to be terrible. The bettors are going to hate it. It's going to cause all sorts of problems. Now, nobody even knows that rule exists at Woodbine. Nobody pays any attention to it. Nobody even talks about it. Everything has gone completely smoothly. There's no signs that it's affected the handle. And I haven't seen any signs that it's been a safety factor. So what will we be? We'll be in about our 90th podcast, closing day at Monmouth Park next year. I want you to write that in right now. Let's go back and review what happened with whip controversy in New Jersey. And if I'm right, and that is going to be the way it's going to happen, then they provided a blueprint for the rest of the sport to follow.
I mean, without taking a position, I mean, I'm in favor of maintaining the whip for Joe, exactly the reasons you articulated. It's not going to attract new fans to the game because it's not there, and it's going to disengender those people who support the game. So, like my biggest problem with it is that, and you've seen some pushback on social media from people like Samantha Siegel and Maggie Moss, like how can you not involve the chief constituents in the discussion? How do you make this rule from on high? Like Bill, what Joe Bravo told you about, these are people that almost certainly lack horsemanship skills. I guess the commissioner said that she rides horses, and Bravo said, well, with all due respect, that's around in a circle. But how do you not solicit opinions, at least from jockeys? How do you not include owners? And I mean, there's an argument that goes, how do you not include the betting public? Because I think there is the possibility that it turns people away. And maybe you're right, Bill. Maybe there is no material impact. And I'd be curious to look at after Woodbine, see what the handle numbers look like from there. But I just think the process really stinks in my mind.
I just want to piggyback off of what Al's saying. Whereas, like the two groups of people who have the most skin in the game for this issue are jockeys and bettors, and it doesn't seem like there has been any consideration of what their preferences are or what the process that they work through. Like, you know how hard it is to bet on horse racing and make money? You know how many hurdles and hoops you have to jump through to bet on the right horse and how many things can go wrong in the course of a race? And now you're going to add this other variable where if I bet a horse and he's about to go by the other horse at the 16th pole and then he darts to the outer rail or he doesn't switch leads or something that could have been corrected with the whip or just a couple of taps of the whip, like, I'm going to be disgusted and I'm going to walk away. And we already have a dwindling customer base when it comes to bettors. And that's the engine that drives the sport. You don't have bettors, you don't have a sport. So I think adding yet another obstacle to the already almost impossible task of trying to make money betting the horses is not well thought out. I mean, we've talked about this before, and if you want to have restrictions in place, I'm all for that. If you want to make it more humane, I'm all for that. But just getting rid of it completely, I think, is a blunt instrument from people who don't bet on the horses and don't ride the horses. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, well, I'm going to say something else. But Joe, you talk about how people who bet on the horses ride the horses. Of course they matter. But throughout this whole discussion, no one has brought up the general public. And I've said this before. Yes, jockeys are important. Yes, Joe Bianco, whether he's going to bet on the six at Monmouth, but then says, no, I'm not going to bet on it because there's no whip, so I'm instead going to bet on the fifth at Saratoga. Obviously, that's important. But this, be it right or wrong, the future of this sport is not going to be dictated by the insiders. It's going to be dictated by the general public. And look what has happened in California. And it didn't involve whipping, I understand that. But look how close this sport teetered on the very verge of extinction. People can bitch about PETA all they want. I hate PETA too. They're terrible. People can bitch about politicians that don't understand racing. But to say that their opinions don't matter, they do. Because they are going to decide the future of this industry. And, you know, I think we had all hoped that we wouldn't go down this road. But next time you talk to a friend who has nothing to do with horse racing, and they say, wait a minute, you whip the animal to make them go faster? In 2020, with the circus gone, with SeaWorld gone, with dog racing gone, the way the general public feels about it, they could be totally wrong. It could be the most unabusive thing in the world. But to not care what the general public thinks about this sport is really naive, because it is the politicians of the world, the PETAs of the world, like them or not, that are going to decide the direction the sport goes. And in 2020, look, this is not 1963 anymore. In 2020, people are not going to accept the fact that we whip horses. And their opinion counts a lot more than mine, yours, and the jockeys. And that yes, that might be wrong. It probably is wrong in some respects. But that's the reality of the situation we're dealing with.
I guess I just don't see, I don't see and hear the public outcry about this that I did with the breakdowns. I thought that was a much, much bigger issue that we had to control than this. I think maybe this is more of a slow burn issue where people are fed up with it and they don't mention it all the time. But I don't know. I don't see the public outcry for that. And this is an interesting case because this is an area where the interest of the bettors and the fans and the insiders and the general public, as it were, are not aligned. Because when it came to the breakdowns, that's an easy thing to get everybody to rally around to fix, because nobody in racing wants to see horses break down. Nobody wants to see horses die. Nobody wants to see trainers get away with drugging horses. So when it comes to the drugs and the breakdowns, that's an easy thing to get everybody on the same page about. This is a little bit different and a little bit more nuanced because you have conflicting interests. And I think that the industry is trying to do this one size fits all approach to it. And I don't think it's wise long-term. And I agree with what you're saying, Bill, that you do have to take the PR impact into account more than you ever did in racing. I 100% agree with you there, but I just don't think that this is well thought out in terms of the long-term implications to the bettors and to a lesser extent, the jockeys.
I think I'm going to say again, it'll be fascinating to revisit this conversation at the end of the Monmouth meet next year. I expect that it'll go off without a hitch. The handle will be in line. Now, comparing COVID numbers to non-COVID numbers is going to be next to impossible, but there'll be no evidence that the handle is going to go down whatsoever, as it has not gone down at Woodbine, and that the races are going to be run safely. if I'm wrong, I'll be the first person to admit I'm wrong and say, you know what, this really was a bad idea. But I think that the people on the other side of the fence need to adapt that same attitude and say, okay, it's going to happen. We're going to have to deal with it. Let's see how it works out. And I go back to the Woodbine example. I mean, has anything happened at Woodbine to suggest that their rules have had a negative impact on racing? Not that I can see. Now, granted, these are stricter rules. We'll find out. Right now it's all just a bunch of hot air. That's what you get paid the big bucks for here on the writer's room to, you know, pontificate with a lot of it there. But let's save the state, Joe, for we will review this conversation when the Mammoth meet. I guess a little meet at the end of the Meadowlands season as well, the Thoroughbred meet, and find out what happened.
All right, so not a huge weekend of racing last week. We're going to, I feel like, steadily ramp up going up to the Breeders' Cup. There's a lot to talk about from this weekend, but just wanted to run down some of the performances from last weekend. Obviously, Starship Jubilee was the headliner. We're going to talk to Kevin Attard, the trainer. She won the Woodbine Mile, beat the boys, just one of the most cool horses in training, one of the most lucrative claims, I would say, of the modern era. So she was impressive there. She got a 103 by her and just pretty much shows up every single time. Canadian Horse of the Year last year. But also the two-year-olds on Sunday at Woodbine were the story, particularly Gretzky the Great in the Summer Stakes. He's a progressive type. He seems to be getting better with each start. He was Nyquist's first stakes winner last month when he won the Soaring Free Stakes up at Woodbine, and now he's his second Grade One winner already, which is pretty impressive. There have only been a handful Grade Ones, I think four now, Grade One races, or six, I guess, with the Del Mar races, Grade One races for two-year-olds so far, and he's already won two of them. Got an 83 buyer, so nothing to write home about there, but visually, I thought, did it really well. It was nice to see your first Grade One win for Kazushi Kimura. Seems to be a really nice, likable kid. Good on Mark Cassie and Eclipse for letting him stick with the horse. So hopefully he gets to keep him all the way to the Breeders' Cup. So that was really cool to see. Always nice to see some new blood at the top of the game, whether it's in the owner, trainer, or the jockey ranks. Lady Spite Spear was the filly who won the Natalma. She was a TDN Rising Star. Not quite as impressive, but also seems to have a lot of potential for the future. Just a couple other races to touch on. They were the Belmont Oaks. It was a short field, but Magic Attitude won it for Arno Delacour and Castellano, daughter of Galileo. And then the Salvatore Mile at the home track of Monmouth. I remember John was really upset about that DQ. Pirates Punch got DQ'd. I think a lot of people thought unjustifiably in the Islin, and he really was much the best in the Salvatore Mile. So the trainer, Grant Forster, says they're going to go to the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile. Yes, next, the big-ass fans, Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile. So those were the couple of the performances that caught my eyes. I wonder if anybody else saw anything they liked.
Basically, I was pleased to see the Belmont Oaks, go off without a hitch. And the fact that, Europeans finished first and third in the race was interesting. How about no Chad Brown in a turf Grade One race at Belmont? That was the biggest story takeaway for me and surprise. Gritsky the Great, ran a picture perfect race. I think Kimura did a really nice job on the horse. And, you talk about interesting breeding. It's Nyquist out of a Bernardini mare. So again, Bernardini showing up as a great broodmare sire and a Darley on Darley, mating on that one. Nyquist exploded onto the scene. And I know just from the Keeneland yearling sales, if it was a Nyquist or Not This Time, I mean, it was automatically going to be a six, figure horse right out of the gate. So Nyquist really, his horses are really showing up and doing well. The 83 buyer, Joe, the only thing I'll say is that the past 2 years for that division, for the juvenile the 2 year old turf Breeders' Cup races, the winning buyer number was an 80 and a 79 respectively the past 2 years. So the fact that Gretzky the Great ran an 83 already shows that he's a little bit ahead of the curve right now. We had a nice third in there as well with Dalder Grand. And I think it's safe to say that the top three horses in that race are going to go to the Breeders' Cup. So that's interesting because of COVID. It looks like that the Canadian jockeys will not be riding in Kentucky because they would have to come. My understanding is they'd have to go through a 2-week quarantine protocol pre and post race. So my understanding is that they're not going to be coming in. So I know Marquez is looking for a rider for both of those entries. I'll text, online Mark's cell number for all you jockey agents that want to have a shot at getting, a mount on those horses. But the best race I personally enjoyed watching was Lady Spite Sphere. I think Emma Jane Wilson did just a phenomenal job on that filly, gave her a perfect trip, and actually ran a little bit faster than the boys did in the Summer Stakes. So hats off to her. And Lady Spite Sphere ran a 76 buyer number. So all those races were pretty impressive. Like you said, we're going to talk to the trainer, Kevin Attard, the trainer of Starship Jubilee, in great detail about that Grade One win. But overall, even though it wasn't a lot of races, I thought there was some quality racing at the upper level in the Grade One races this weekend.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that about the figures for those two races, because horses like Decorated Invader and I believe Catch a Glimpse won the filly equivalent a few years ago. So good horses win those races and just don't get big figures, and then go on to do to run okay in the Breeders' Cup as well. So just a couple other things. How about David Anderson? David Anderson. Anderson Farms in Ontario bred Gretzky the Great, and earlier in the week sold a $1.6 million yearling by Medaglia d'Oro half to Sergei Prokofiev. So I'd say that was a pretty good week for David Anderson. And John, you pointed out that Gretzky the Great is sort of Darley on Darley by Nyquist out of a Bernardini mare. That same breeding, the cross Uncle Mo over Bernardini, is also responsible for a horse like Motown, Grade One winner on turf, standing at Coolmore. So heady breeding there. It's interesting that there was such a difference. Those races were two races apart. I think the colts were 0.8 seconds faster, but the buyer you said was 83 for the boys and 76 for the girls, John?
That's correct. Yep, you're spot on. Yeah.
Well, that's a bit interesting.
I think it had more to do with the fact that Lady Spite Sphere, really had a perfect trip. Didn't have any excess distance to cover at all, as opposed to Gretzky the Great, who sat off it and had to go a little bit wide. Some would say got in the way of Ready to Repeat. The stewards would not say that, but certainly Gretzky the Great had to work, I think, a little bit harder. And also, unfortunately, I think because it's the boys, I think they naturally get a little bit higher buyer number, just by that nature.
And your horse ran well, thought covered some ground, and maybe a little green there at the eighth pole, but got home okay after that. Had every reason not to finish in the top three, but came back for third. So that was a good effort.
Yeah, we thought if the jockey had use of the whip, that'd be a different story.
Don't even go there, John. Right, and then the Natama, another TDN rising star, Alda, came from further back. The pace wasn't all that great. But she ran second, daughter of Munnings, TDN rising star to Lady Spite Sphere. And Lady Spite Sphere certainly made up for the disappointment of Cheryl Spite in the Woodbine Mile. But Magic Attitude. How about 89 Group 1 and Grade 1 winners for Galileo? That's just an insane, unconscious sort of number. And, hats off to Starship Jubilee. She won the E.P. Taylor last year, which is one of the marquee races, 10 furlongs at Woodbine, and now drops back to a mile and beats the boys in the Woodbine Mile. So it will be interesting to see what that, like Bill pointed out in his week in review, which way they'll go for Breeders' Cup. The mile is likely to attract some, handful of horses from overseas, but you'd have to say there's nothing. I mean, if War of Will was the barometer, if he's one of our top turf horses and she beat him on the square, there's no reason that she couldn't. She certainly fits in there. Let's say that. So interesting to see if she goes there or tries the 9.5 in the Filling Bear turf.
I just wanted to mention what we've got going on this weekend. We've got 6 Breeders' Cup winning year end spots. The Vosburgh at Belmont for the sprint. We got the American Pharaoh, the Awesome Again, the Chandelier, the Rodeo Drive, and the Speakeasy at Santa Anita. Actually, there's two more on Sunday as well, the Santa Anita Sprint Championship and the Zenyatta Stakes. I think by far the most interesting race is the Awesome Again, because Bob Baffert said earlier this week that he's going to run both improbable and maximum security in that race, which we talked about that earlier in the summer when improbable won the Whitney and maximum security won the Pacific Classic, whether or not he was going to keep those two apart. Seems like at least for now, he's not going to. I would assume they would meet up again in the Classic if they both stay together. But that's super interesting to me because that's improbable is a real grade one horse. You know, with all due respect to the horses that were in the Pacific Classic, maximum security was not beaten up on grade one horses in that race. And he's going to have, I think, the biggest test he's had as a four-year-old, or at least since the Saudi Cup, with his own barn mate, Improbable, in the Awesome Again. So that's going to be super interesting. Just wanted to give a pop to the two-year-olds that'll be racing overseas at Newmarket. We've got the Royal Lodge Stakes, the Sheepleaf Park Stakes, and the Middle Park Stakes. Two of the latter two are grade one or group ones. So we'll keep an eye on the two-year-olds this weekend, both here and abroad. So contrary to popular belief, we are glad to have John Green back after his one-week hiatus from going down to Keeneland in September. So just wanted to get some quick thoughts from him about the sale and also a particular horse that will be running with a very special name.
That's right. Thank you for that softball pitch of a lead, Joe. I appreciate that. So the Keeneland sale, you know, you guys did a great job last week with the interview, you know, talking about the Keeneland sale and what they were expecting. And it was, you know, true to form. I mean, the top horses were selling for a ton of money, and there was definitely a money grab scramble for the horses in that mid-level. And I know just from being, you know, on a couple of those horses that are considered mid-level horses, that even if we didn't bid on a horse, we were getting calls and texts and inquiries from consigners. Hey, I saw that you vetted the horse out. Hey, I saw that you were interested in this horse. Why didn't you buy it? Or it was an RNA. We actually bought more horses after the sale in an RNA negotiation than we did actually in the ring. So if that gives you any indication of how difficult it was to sell that mid-level horse. One of the most interesting things I noticed this year about the sale, and this is a real credit to Keeneland for doing this, is that they spelled out before the sale in the pre-sale announcements, they spelled out all the rules and regulations regarding dual agency and post-sale blood testing. And why is that important? Well, number one, they wanted everyone to know that dual agency, meaning working for a buyer and getting paid for services, and then also getting subsequently paid by the seller, was against the law in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, number one, unless you had written consent from both parties. So what they were trying to do is make unlawful what's been going on for decades, which is an agent who's representing me as a buyer. You know, we're interested in a horse. We're going to bid $100,000 on the horse. They then go to the consigner and say, hey, consigner, I think that horse is probably worth about $50,000. If I get my guy to bid $100,000 for the horse, then everything above $50,000 we split. Well, that's against the law now in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. It wasn't before. So I'm glad that not only did they change the rules, but that they announced it before the sale. The other is with regard to blood testing. It is now illegal to use antibiotic steroids, anti-inflammatories, clenbuterol, and a list of other medications on yearlings that are going to sale. And you as the buyer have the right to do a post-sale blood test. I don't know a lot of people who have done it. We actually did it for one horse just kind of to see what would happen with the testing. But basically, if the blood test comes back and the horse is positive for any of the banned substances, we can return the horse. And there's a penalty to be paid by the seller and consigner if they do show up with a negative blood test. So I'm really pleased with that. On top of all that, they were doing an excellent job with the COVID protocol. So all in all, you know, there was a lot going on that had nothing to do with the actual horses themselves, but had to do with the rules and regulations and protocols of the sale. So I'm pleased that all those things were not only being enforced, but also announced pre-sale every day, when they were going over all the rules of the sale. More importantly, in the course of our picking up some yearlings. And ironically enough, this wasn't even a yearling that we purchased at Keeneland. It was a horse that was picked up by our super scout, Kim Valerio. We now have a horse that is named Writer's Room. So in honor of everyone involved, it is it's very appropriate. It is an outwork, which our behind the scenes, you know, group, Patty Wolf and her team, outworks everybody to make us look good. And the mayor is All Talk, which is, you know, named after Joe, I think. I thought it was very appropriate that we named that horse Writer's Room. And the icing on the cake is that she is a New York bred as well. So
yeah.
On top of everything else, we will see her campaign hopefully in New York next Saratoga, and hopefully have some more things to talk about on the Writer's Room about Writer's Room.
Put her on your stable mails, all of you, right now. Can't wait. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So this week, our Green Group Guest of the Week is the trainer of maybe the greatest claim of all time, Starship Jubilee, Kevin Attari. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So let's go back to the beginning. I'm sure you've told this story 100 different times, but you've never told it on this show to our audience. What made your dad, Tino, decide to claim a $16,000 filly off of Jorge Navarro, of all people?
Yeah, you know, we were just looking for horses to kind of bring back to Woodbine at the time. You know, at Gulfstream, it's really tough to claim. You're always kind of shaking for the, you know, horses that look, you know, I mean, legit on paper and have good form to them. So we had gotten out shook a lot of times with a couple of the claims we had put in. She had come across, on form, like she looked like she had some potential, had run some decent enough races. Seemed like she was appreciating maybe to kind of stretch out a little bit. So, we took a chance, and we were lucky enough to win the shake that day, and the rest is history, really.
Hey, Kevin, it's Bill Finley, and thanks for joining us, and congratulations on the Woodbine Mile win. And I believe at this point you haven't made your decision yet about which Breeders' Cup race, but could you sort of go through the pluses and minuses and what the thinking is, whether you go in the Breeders' Cup Mile or the Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Turf?
Well, yeah. So right now we're still a little undecided. Obviously, there's some more prep races to kind of come along, and we'll kind of watch how they unfold. Obviously, you know what I mean? With the mile race, I think, you know what I mean? The way I look at it is you anticipate a stronger early pace. I think that gives her a better chance to settle early, and she seems to have a really good turn of foot. So I think that helps her in a race again in the mile. Obviously you're facing males, which, you know, I mean, is not easy for a filly or a mare to do, but they've done it in the past with success. So with the filly race, it's a mile 3/16. I think it's upper alley. I do think she's, arguably, she was, I thought she was always best at a mile and an eighth. She's won going a mile, a quarter. Obviously, the mile 3/16 is, probably enough where she should be able to handle it. But obviously, both races are going to be, tough races. There's leaders in both of those divisions that are pretty tough and formidable. So, she's going to have to run her best, no doubt about it. But we're just happy to kind of be in the position we are right now.
And Kevin, obviously Starship Jubilee loves Woodbine, 14 starts, 7 wins, 2 seconds and a third, and well over $1 million in purses earned just at Woodbine. So I understand the rationale behind running her on your home track. What ultimately made you decide to run her in the Woodbine Mile, especially knowing that March to the Arch, War of Will, Sure Spiel were all in there? I mean, your filly was 6-1. It wasn't like, you're putting her in there and she was 4-5. So it was a little bit of a gamble.
Yeah, you look at her record and she just loves to win, whether it's Woodbine, Gulfstream. She's obviously had success at Saratoga. So, obviously with us being based at home, there hasn't been much reason in the past to kind of ship. This year it was a little different. Her obviously when we were stabled at Gulfstream for the winter, her first 3 races were in South Florida, first three. And then COVID hit and we were planning on going to the Jenny Wiley, and with COVID that kind of derailed things. We shelved her for a bit just to freshen her up. Her next 2 spots were in Saratoga because nothing really fit the schedule at Woodbine with her. And I thought in her last race and the Diana, she just looked a little hot on post parade, and I started to get a little concerned in the sense that maybe the shipping might be getting to her, just kind of, doing her training here, putting her on a van, although it's not a bad drive to New York, you know, there's only so much they can take, right? So I really wanted to find a race locally at home. And again, the Philly and Mare race locally, it came up a little sooner than we wanted. I thought a little bit more time for her would be beneficial. I wasn't concerned about cutting her back to a mile because she does have a good record at a mile. So obviously, you know what I mean, going against the boys, knowing War of Will was being pointed to here for some time, those were all things that we kind of took into consideration. But just knowing my filly, knowing that if she did show, happen to run her best race, that she'd be very competitive.
Hey, Cameron, Alan Carrasco, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
You've had plenty of success up at Woodbine, going back to the 2001 Summer Stakes. I think that was your first graded win. But can you talk about what it meant to you personally to win the Ballston Spa at a place like Saratoga?
Yeah, obviously, you know what I mean, with the history of Saratoga and everything, to win a graded race there was really special. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend. That's a little disappointing in that, but just to see her win there, obviously to see her beat a champion that day as well, in Sister Charlie, you know, a horse that, has been the top of the division for a long time, meant a lot. And, you know, this filly just, it's, you know, every time you send her somewhere, she just kind of gives it her all. She runs her heart out. And whenever you have a horse that tries each and every time, it means that much more to you.
I wanted to ask about her personality, because like you said, she's a win machine. She always shows up. She hasn't been off the board basically in forever. What do you attribute that to? Is it something in her training? Is it something in her personality? What makes her special that she always shows up and always tries hard?
Well, she's just a very competitive horse. Like even in the morning, she's not an easy filly to train, in the sense when the tack's on her, she wants to go. You have to have a good exercise rider on her. And Ricardo Pilgrim, who's been galloping her, has done a great job with her here at Woodbine. So we've been fortunate with that. She's very feisty, has a lot of sass and attitude towards her. Not a typical filly that you can just kind of hug up and or cuddle up to. You know, she's got some fire, and if you're not on your toes, you know, she'll bite you. She could kick you. Like, she's really really a handful when she needs to be, and I think that really transpires onto the racetrack. She just brings that attitude with her to the track, whether it's her competing against obviously the fillies and mares or the boys, she's just ready to kind of lay it down and give it her best.
Hey, Kevin, I did a quick look and I came up with no fewer than 6 Attards. Kevin, Sid, Jamie, Tino, Steve, and Larry. Could you explain the Attard family tree? Who's who? Who's what? Who's related to whom and how? And why are there so many Attards in Canadian racing?
So Tino is my dad. And Joe, who passed away, he was the oldest brother. He was the first brother to arrive to Canada from Malta. And then Sid and Larry followed suit as well. So they're all brothers. Obviously, growing up as a child in a racetrack family, and I can say, kind of probably speak on behalf of my cousin Steve and my cousin Jamie, who's also training, and actually Mike DiPaolo's wife, who's his assistant, Josie DiPaolo. She's Joe Attard's daughter. We spent the majority of times when we're not in school here at the track, and there's a passion and a love for horses that you get. It's a 7-day job, 7-day a week job, early hours, some days long evenings, so it's not something you do really for the money. You do for the love of the animal and obviously the competition. The more successful you are, obviously the money starts to kind of fall into that situation. But as we all know, it's a tough game. And I think as kids, grew up at the racetrack, really, on the weekends. I didn't play hockey like most kind of Canadian kids. I enjoyed being at the track and watching my dad and watching the horses and working with them. I started working with them at a young age. And it was something, originally I wanted to be a jockey, but quickly ate myself out of that job. And obviously training was the next thing that I kind of wanted to do. And here I am and doing what I love, I guess.
Yep. No, Kevin, that's a great answer. And it's always nice when you have a family business and you get to share it with family. I'm sure that adds a lot to it as well. One of the questions, Kevin, that we ask a lot of the trainers that come on the show is, how would you make racing better? And people have come up with answers about medication rules, whip rules, education for owners. What would you suggest if you could be czar for the day of racing to make it better, for the overall sport?
Well, I definitely think we need uniform medication rules across the board. I think that's for sure. And I think there's more good people that play the game than bad. Unfortunately, it's always the bad stuff, the negative stuff that gets kind of publicized. But there are a lot of hardworking individuals back here on a day-to-day basis. And I mean, personally, I think we need to open up the backside a little bit more to the general public and see the everyday work that's done to these horses, the care that's put into them. It's just a different side that people don't get to see. And I honestly believe that if people were allowed kind of to freely get back here and see how things operate, how well the horses are looked after, how magnificent of an animal they are, and how much they actually enjoy doing what they do, then I think we'd get more fans, attract more new people to the game, and I think we'd just be better off overall.
Kevin, I'm wondering what her future disposition is. She's obviously been offered once as a horse of racing age at Keeneland a couple of years ago. Obviously, her value has skyrocketed since then. Have you been approached privately, or are there plans to offer her again at public auction?
Well, earlier in the year, there was an offer made privately for her. I personally don't see the owners selling. They operate a breeding operation. They bought her with the intention of breeding her. Obviously, that's a decision for them to be made. But at this moment of time, they're obviously enjoying the ride. She's brought a lot of fun to everybody who's been involved with her. We're excited now. We're kind of heading to the Breeders' Cup. We've got an automatic berth, obviously. And I guess we'll just kind of, just like her races, we're taking it day by day. And obviously the day's going to come where she's going to need to retire and go on to her next career. But for the moment, we're just enjoying what we're kind of dealt with right now. And hopefully this kind of Cinderella ride continues.
Cinderella ride is a great way to put it. I want to congratulate you, not just on the Woodbine Mile, but keeping her together and keeping her happy all this time. She's closing in on her 8-year-old season and still seems better than ever. So congrats to you and congrats to the connections, Kevin.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, it's definitely, a good testament to the horse that she is at 7 years old, that she is sound and healthy and competing at the highest level.
But a great training job as well, as much as you don't want to take credit for it.
I appreciate it. All right, guys. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Kevin.
Take care. You. All right.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Kevin Attard will receive a free 1-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over 4 decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Remember, Keeneland September runs through this Friday, September 25th. That'll lead into the fall meet, which then leads into the Breeders' Cup, and then Keeneland November. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, Alan Carrasso, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Kevin Attard, our producer, Patty Wolf, our editors, Nathan Wilkinson and Danny Siper, and our production coordinator, Michelle Sabrino. Thanks so much for watching. Wear a mask. We'll see you next week.